So thank you, everyone, for coming. I should mention before we get started that this it is being recorded this evening. So if you have something that you don't want recorded, maybe don't say it. So first, I want to say thank you to the Berkman Center for sponsoring this event. I think it's something that I know is happening all over campus. Good thinking about digital media, about learning, and about what it means for schools. And I know there are a lot of people here from all over, from public schools in the area, from the Ed School, from all over. So I'm really excited to have the conversation after the film. So I want to start by just saying a few words, and then we're just going to get right into it. I could say, in a very blanket way, that kids learn differently online. The web gives them unprecedented access to networks of people, places, and things. And online and increasingly offline, they can make, remake, and remix the culture around them. So tonight, we focus on the affordances of this new learning, putting aside for a moment the challenges of distraction, of violence, of social pressure, and other sorts of social ills so often associated with young people and media. So we refocus the lens on kids inventing, making, and engaging the world around them. And we ask, is school enough? Can schools in their present form accommodate this new learning? And is that desirable? So tonight's program is in two parts. First, we'll watch a wonderful new documentary that explores the questions of what, when, and how kids learn, and informally and with new forms. And then we'll have a discussion led by a panel that features not only the producer of the documentary, Steve Brown, but an esteemed group of people from the Berkman Center and some of the remarkable young people featured in the film. So I'll introduce our panel after the 50-minute documentary, and we'll also have other people that that are nearby that I'll call on and ask for your input. It's not really going to be a panel discussion as much as it's going to be a discussion with everybody in the room. So please start thinking and let's get this conversation going. So for now, please sit back and relax and enjoy the 50-minute film. Well, I want to ask our panel, to come up here. Again, just as the panel is more like a backboard, springboard, let's say, to throw ideas at, and we'll see what happens. So let me just introduce everybody very quickly, and we also have other people that I want to introduce as well, but if you can get on these strangely high chairs. I forgot to introduce myself. I apologize for that. My name is Eric Gordon. I'm a fellow at the Berkman Center this year. So I'll introduce from this side. This is Sandra Cortesi. She's the lead fellow of the Youth and Media Project at the Berkman Center. Ray Junko is sitting right next to her. He is a faculty associate at the Berkman Center this year as well. And Urs Gasser is the executive director at the Berkman Center. So it's great to have those voices here on the panel. And then we have Sierra Goldstein, who you all know, who needs no introduction. She's sitting on the panel. And then Steve Brown, the director and producer of the documentary we just saw tonight. Those people are all sitting up here, and I'm going to ask them a few questions. But I also, before we start, I want to introduce also on this side, we've got we have Xavier and Monica and Alex. I just want to... Also, we have Xavier over here, teacher Xavier over here also. So I want to start off the conversation tonight with just a simple provocation to the panel. And I have each person say just a very, very quick response to this, and then I'll actually turn to you guys as well if you're willing. But is school enough? Let's start with you, Steve.
Well, I guess for me, it's more than a rhetorical question, as you might be able to tell from the program. No, I don't think so. I'm not sure it's its fault, but I think there's so much more that kids want to do and can do that should be included as part of an education. And I think opportunities there for teachers and classrooms to include more of it relatively easily.
Well, I can tell you from my personal experience and from interacting with other kids in my community that a lot of the times it's not. We want to be able to, as, you know, youth go out there and make a difference and follow our dreams, which, you know, we're always told as kids you should follow your dreams. And in that situation, a lot of the time they get shot down. And, you know, that can be very, very confusing. And so it's really nice to be able to, you know, go outside of those walls and, you know, try new things and figure out your passions. And again, personally, and from interacting with other kids, it's been a lot more beneficial and empowering to do that than sitting in a classroom for 8 hours.
Thank you. Two quick remarks to start with. First of all, I've never been sitting so close to a movie star, which is amazing. And secondly, I've never imagined a more formal setting to discuss informal learning, so I really hope we can open that up relatively quickly. Is cool enough? My answer would be no, but I would add a provocation back by saying, but schools are even more important than ever before. And I think there are three reasons. The first reason was mentioned before and also stated nicely by Henry Jenkins in the documentary. There's a huge window of opportunity, I think, for schools to actually build bridges to other contexts of learning, social and informal spaces of learning. And many teachers, and some of them actually in the room here, are doing already great work to improve learning, to make learning more interest-driven, more community-oriented, more relevant. So I think it's worth later on to look quite closely at the different stories that we've seen, because some of them, one could argue, happen actually at schools already. The second quick remark is our observation along these lines. We have seen wonderful success stories in this documentary, but of course we also know that there are challenges. We are dealing with digital divides and participation gaps along socioeconomic inequalities across the country, and that is quite troublesome because not everyone has the kind of settings and support structures we've seen tonight. Even, again, looking more closely at how many mentors and coaches you have seen here, we shouldn't take that for granted, I guess. So there are challenges, as much as I, of course, love the narrative and also agree on the promise. And the third point, ultimately, why I think schools are more important than ever, has to do with the basic literacies. Much of, I think, what we've seen here happening, especially as far as the use of technology is concerned, also builds upon the ability to read and write and express yourself. And some of these skills, obviously, are deeply connected to school learning and will likely continue to be connected for a long time. So, again, I think school continues to be extremely relevant. What we have is, you know, a great opportunity to build from both sides and connect the learning, indeed.
I agree with a lot of what you said, and I think that that last statement by Henry Jenkins was a great one about needing to connect what's happening outside of the classroom into the classroom, and that learning should be connective. It should be a social process. It should strive to be as engaging as possible, and certainly there are the issues of needing to focus on basic skills, but also focus on other skills that we might not consider basic, but that I might consider basic, like interpersonal skills and conflict resolution and how to work with people and how to collaborate and things like that. And when I say that, I don't mean that we need even more standards, because that just kind of, you know, makes me shiver a bit when we think about adding more standards. I think that that the policy right now is pretty misguided, in that there needs to be a lot of teaching to a test. And that that one size fits all certainly will reach that 68% in the middle, but it doesn't really allow for the ones that for students who need something a little different. And I'm certainly in agreement there about the participation gap in both engagement and in technology use. And I think that and that's some of my research, that we need to focus on how students are using technology in the real world, meeting them where they are in educational settings, and encouraging education through the use of newer technologies, and not shying away from that, how we're currently doing in K through 12.
So I think the movie does a wonderful job at showing the different ways how you can support and excite students about the things they, in a way, wanted to learn. I think one of the challenging questions is also, how can you support schools, students, and teachers to learn and teach the things that are maybe a little bit less fun to learn? And maybe going back to your provocation, one of the policy questions, I think, could be, how can students connect to school if it's such a controlled environment?
Okay, great. I want to see if there's anybody who wants to just jump in at this moment, to go out to the audience right now to either respond to that question or to dig deeper into some of the issues that were brought up in the documentary. Yes, there's a microphone in the back. Actually, you can press a little red button. Yeah.
Sarah, can I ask you a question?
Absolutely.
I'm an elementary teacher. Mm-hmm. I have parents that do not understand letting their children go free mm-hmm. on the internet, and it's a real concern. How do you keep your child safe? How did you overcome that with your parents to let you reach beyond the norm and step outside those walls as you spoke of?
Well.
Sorry.
No. There was a lot of trust involved, because it can be very scary. I mean, as I've had many conversations with my parents, to let your kid, as you said, go out and sort of put themselves out there, especially in that digital social media world, and to try new things that necessarily haven't been done before. And it really took a lot of, I would say, communication, checking in with them, letting them know what I was doing, and having them be an active part of everything that I was doing. So it wasn't necessarily like I was out there by myself doing these things. It was, yes, I was out there and I was putting myself out there, but my parents were with me. They were, you know, my support system, and they knew what I was doing and who I was talking to. So they were really a huge part of it. And so they got to see firsthand what I was doing. And, you know, we would talk about it every night, what I was doing that day, what I wanted to do. So there was a lot of active and purposeful communication involved in that process.
How did you find those initial resources to start that communication?
What do you mean by resources?
Well, how did you know where to go and look to start sharing that information with your parents? Did you have a school mentor that said that there was resources there?
I was a part of the BU Innovation Lab, which is sort of program that allows kids to learn per passion.
Okay.
And my parents were definitely an active part of talking with Monica, who we saw on the documentary, about how this self-directed program worked, and resources. I mean, yeah. So they were a huge part of how this self-directed program worked, and they were always, going to meetings with me, and they got to see, firsthand everything I was doing, from meeting with my mentors on Skype, as you saw, my mom was sitting right next to me, or, going to coffee shops and meeting with my mentors. So they got to see all the educational steps I was taking, which really made them feel like they were even more of an active part of my education than they ever were when I was in school. Because when I was in school, they would drop me off, have a great day, and then pick me up, and there wasn't much more after that. But with this, they really got to see, what I was interested in, who I was talking to, and even the type of learning that works for me. So they could be like, Sierra, I noticed that you're interested in this, and I've also noticed from being around you that you learn best this way, and here's how I can help you. So they were just a complete active part of that.
I wonder if I can actually call in Sierra's mom, who's sitting back there, to chime in on this, if there's anything you want to add. click that little red button on the...
To the resource part, is that what you're trying to get to? I would say one of our mentors, too, was from a company called Room 214, and he taught Sierra a lot about social media, creating those Twitter accounts. She worked with Malika Chopra a lot about the blogging and blogs with intent. So it was a learning process. How did we initiate that conversation? Was a communication every day. There wasn't a one single defining moment. It was conversation every day and learning every day together, which really pushed us into, participating in her life. And it's a gift, actually, that we've been able to do that. So there was no defining resource out there, except for we looked out into the community and connected with geniuses in that community that can then help us create this learning experience. Does that help?
Okay. So it seems like in one of the things that you said, Sierra, which is that your parents became more involved in your life after, when it was no longer just dropping you off at school, and that's just a nice way to frame it. And I wonder if we could talk a little bit about that that kind of formal versus informal tension that we have here. And in some ways, a lot of what was featured in this film are distractions. Traditionally, we would call them distractions. They're apart from the goals of traditional education. And so how do those distractions get sort of recentered? How do they become the center? In your education, it seems extraordinary in the way that it happened. But I wonder if we can talk more broadly about what the practicalities are of taking those things traditionally understood as distractions and then bringing them in to the sort of structure of education. I don't know if anybody on the panel has anything to say about that or anybody else.
Well, I'll comment. I mean, I actually wouldn't necessarily describe the things that we saw as distractions, although I understand why you would. The thing that we were trying to do in all of our stories, and I mean, as I'm sure you can tell already, it's not really about the individual story as a success story that we're really trying to tell. It's really about how that story represents something bigger than that. In Sierra's case, it's about how she's resourced the community and both on and offline to figure out what she wants to do, to learn about what she wants to do. She's really expanding her knowledge base to all these untapped resources that are both online and offline. But to the issue of distraction, I mean, the other thing that we wanted to do is to show stories of kids doing really important work, which I think is too often lacking in the classroom. I mean, they're asked to do work, certainly, but are they asked to do things that are important to people other than the classmates or the teacher? Are they asked to do things that are important to their community and so forth? So I guess I would say that you know, most important thing for us to tell was that all these kids were helping bring an elephant to Maine, which, you know, we all want an elephant in our hometown, I know, especially when it's only 1,000 people. You know, they participated in this big discussion about what to do, what the problems are in public schooling in Boston, for example, and how to fix those. You know, the how to make Warner Brothers use fair trade chocolate and so forth. So those aren't really distractions in the same way that, say, you know, using text messaging or Facebooking or whatever kids are doing and so forth are distractions in the way that we view them that way. These are actually important things, more than just distractions. I didn't mean to veer your question off course there, Eric.
Oh, that's great. Thank you. Ray, you look like you want to say something.
Yeah, you know I do. The whole idea about Facebook and social media's distractions, I guess I rile against in just not only personally, but in my research, that we find that there are some great ways that we can use these tools in education. And what you mentioned before about how do you convince your parents, I think this is a larger kind of societal problem that we've somehow agreed that social technologies are time wasters at best and very evil or dangerous places at worst. And I think the media is also to blame for this, because you get a lot of media hype about, you know, here's, let me show you what's bad, what's bad, and what's bad. And I think that if I could summarize my research in one sentence, it would be that it's not about whether or not youth or students are using social technologies. It's about what they're doing on those social technologies. So, for instance, some of my research findings show that if kids are playing games on Facebook, right, Farmville, I'm so happy to have research results that show that Farmville and Mafia Wars are bad for you. Because, you know, I always hated them polluting my stream and Facebook anyway. But the point is that games like that actually have a negative effect on learning and a negative effect on engagement, whereas things like checking in to see what your friends are doing, what kids call Facebook stalking or Facebook creeping, actually has a more positive effect. And we've also shown in experimental studies how you can integrate things like Twitter to get more positive learning outcomes. And Eric has done some of this work, too. He's got a paper with some of the technology they developed for their classroom. And so I really rile against that idea that social technologies are bad. I think we need to figure out some ways to integrate them very effectively in education.
Well, I think it's interesting that in our experience with Community Planet, what became clear is we ran into some barriers, as we always do whenever we use Community Planet in school systems, which is that the most social media is blocked. And so we couldn't get onto YouTube and we couldn't get onto Facebook and to do the things that we needed to do. And these guys got around it with a little help from their teacher. But but it was amazing to watch. It was like what they did was they were producing amazing things. They needed access to YouTube in order to do it. And they did it in school. And it's those kinds of that kind of learning that was going on because of social media are those examples of real productive learning experiences where sort of sledgehammer policies of just blocking social media is not necessarily the best way to go. So I don't know if you guys want to chime in, please.
I'm Alex Jesus. I had a statement about you guys talking about how to control students, how like standards and things like that. But I feel that is true, but that is for people who know what they want. Like, I don't know what I want. So for me to if my school was more geared for those who wanna, you know, express themselves freely and things like that, I feel like that's great, because when you have a standard, you're killing the potential. You're killing what the kids could have been if they would have chased their dream. But then again, you put me in a position where I was forced to be in this class when I first started. But then I realized I love, you know, media. So, but when I follow the standards and the guides, I feel like, you know, that isn't always the worst thing. I feel like we're talking a lot about people that know what they want, and we're not talking enough about people who don't know what they want. The average guy, the average person who's applying to college and is going undecided, or who doesn't want to go to college because maybe they're scared. We should always encourage kids to do what they want, and you know, and have the ability to chase their dream. But also, we should also, you know, be able to give the kids who don't know what they want guidance, and also meet mentors and try things. I feel like we should be focusing a lot on that.
I'd like to add something to that. Something that I've learned from doing this lab, and something that I love that you said, was experiment. And I think that, you know, when kids don't know what they want to do, they need the freedom to experiment with different things. And you can't, you're not brought into life knowing exactly what you want to do. It takes life experiences and, you know, trying out different things to realize what your main passion is. And then once you have that, you can go out and you can find mentors and people that are doing those things that can help support you. And you can have people to help support you through that experimentation process. So, you know, I see sort of a, like I said in the documentary, a network of people who are, you know, giving you ideas of things to try, or if you have an inch, you know, or you can go and try that thing, and then you might not like it, but then you might love it, and then that's your passion, and then you can do that. And, you know, setting that standard doesn't allow kids to go out and do that. And, you know, I feel that's very disempowering. And so I loved that you said experimentation, and that just is so, so true to be able to figure out what you want to do.
Yes.
I'm curious what you think about the future of people making connections online where they never met that person before, because it seems to me like the more technology gets into our personal lives, the less people are comfortable just striking up conversations like people usually used to do more often. And I'm curious, like, are people going to start meeting each other for the first time based on Twitter, based on Facebook, based on Skype or whatever, and how do you see that playing out in the next 5 years?
Well, the assumption that people aren't striking up conversations anymore is not upheld in any of the research. So the research absolutely shows that people who are communicating online are also communicating offline. The idea of meeting strangers doesn't tend to happen that much either. Again, the research shows that people who you're connecting with online are people who you have some kind of tie to. The research calls those like the strong or the weak ties. And so in the future, are people going to meet more and connect more online? I would think so. I mean, I think that happens now for me professionally. I meet people, they'll see my blog, or they'll, you know, find me on Twitter, and they'll say something about me or to me. Or about some of my work, and then we'll end up meeting at a conference or at some kind of forum like this. So, so I think that we'll probably see about the same. Maybe if we're, you know, kind of extending out 30, 40 years when we have implants and, you know, we can access the internet by kind of blinking, maybe that might be different. But I don't think that's going to substantially change all that much in the near future.
So one thing to add maybe to that, I also think that there is a big value in maybe having those mentors or people online and not necessarily even meeting them offline. But throughout the movie, you see a couple of times where online mentors played a big role. And that's, for example, something how we could think about scaling mentorship could be a potential in there, I think.
Oh, I just wanted to speak to the issue of using social media for learning, because while I really appreciated the examples that were given in the film, they're kind of cherry-picked, and the average student isn't going to start their own business necessarily or their own video recording company. And I'm kind of thinking about the comment made by the Boston English student here across the room of, how about the child that's trying to find themselves? And just as an anecdotal reference, I have a child who's being home educated for high school, and she's doing her education online. Using MIT's open sourceware, and she's taking some classes at Harvard Extension, and she's really used Facebook to help her define her career goals. She found she wants to study neurobiology, and she found a Facebook site in Australia, Body and Mind, another one called Neuroorthopedic Institute, and then there's another institute in London, and she reads online articles that are published for free. She could never do this at the public high school in our town. And so I think, I mean, as we're looking at, is school enough? I think we're looking at ways to augment what school does, not necessarily replace it. But I'm particularly interested in bringing this back to the discussion of the panel up front. How does one find the mentors that one needs to help direct this educational process? So if anybody who wants to speak to it, especially I suppose Sierra, because she's done this, but I'm open to whatever anybody has to contribute. Thank you.
I'd just like to give one example, actually. Sorry, I mean to hold on. We worked on an initial story of this girl, she's 14, named Catherine, who lives in Mount Pleasant, Michigan. And she had this idea at 14 that she wanted a Pontiac Fiero, which I don't know if anybody knows what those are, but they're around for 4 years, and the first year they burned most of the time. They caught on fire. But they're very sporty, two-seater. And she wanted a Pontiac Fiero, so she bought one for $450, and she's now with her father rebuilding this car. And so she's got the engine spread out in the basement and the chassis out in her uncle's garage and so forth. But she created this forum on there's a Fiero forum, of course, more than one. She created this forum where basically she's been sort of crowdsourcing the resources that she needs to rebuild this car. And like that's a, you know, that's a very simple and direct way of saying that if you're interested in something, there are thousands of people out there who are also interested in it and are more than willing to give you help in all sorts of ways about all sorts of arcane subjects like Pontiac Fieros. So, I mean, that's totally tied to learning. And that's believe me, it's a big project that she's taking on. She's welding, she's rebuilding the engine, she's doing all kinds of stuff. And
so
she's
how
online.
Specifically did she get the mentors for that?
Her mentors are untapped resources all over the world. I mean, people in Australia, people all over the country are saying to her, I know what to do about that particular problem.
So they're finding her, and then they're contacting her,
yeah,
or they're finding
talk
her website?
They talk in the forum. And she's become known on the Fiero website because she's doing this extraordinary thing, and she's 14 and so forth. So that's, you know, it's like that.
No, you're fine. You know, you asked how, because I've done this, how I found my mentors online through social media. And, you know, to me, social media is really just a big web for all of us to connect. And there's so many different avenues with the blogging, and there's YouTube and Twitter and Facebook, all these different things where all these people are putting out information. And what I really did is I went out and looked for the information that I was interested in. So say yoga, for example. So I would go and I would search, you know, yoga hashtags on Twitter and, you know, yoga teachers on Google. And I would find these people and I would start following them religiously, you know, retweeting them, following their blogs, commenting. And eventually, you know, you make enough of an impression that they start contacting you back. And then you start creating those relationships. And through those relationships, mentoring naturally happens. And so I found a lot of my mentors from following their information, putting out my own information, and, you know, tweeting it to them saying, hey, here's my blog. You know, I really think we could connect. Read it and tell me what you think. And because of that, I've met some, you know, amazing mentors that have completely changed my life. And I've been able to, you know, create a bigger voice. I'm actually a frequent blogger on Malika Chopra's intent.com, which has helped me connect with numerous people because it's such a big website. So, you know, using social media to find mentors is actually quite easy and natural when you're putting out information and then searching for information that means something to you. So it's fairly easy, and it's amazing the people you can meet from all around the world. And, you know, again, because of social media, you can connect with them every day, you know, over Skype. And you have 24/7 support. And it's, you know, an amazing feeling to have that many people by your side. And then you're learning and gaining new information all day, every day, to put into your education and into your life to move forward.
I want to go back to something that Alex said, though, earlier. Is that, is this really a dichotomy between between structured and unstructured? Is that really the problem here? Because I hear what you're saying, that if you know what you want, then the web is fabulous because you can just follow your dreams and you can get it. But if you don't, then you need that structure. And I hear that from your comment. And I don't want to go down the path in this conversation to say that it's an either or choice. And I don't think that's what we're talking about here. Yes.
Well, related to that, I think there's a question about equality and access. A question about equality and access, and that's a question I think for the panelists and maybe, you know, other people in the room, is, you know, what if people don't really have time out of school to explore what they want to do? What if they're working 20 plus hours a week, or, you know, helping their parents, or maybe they have a single parent at home? What if they don't have the structures to, you know, even have adult mentors to talk to? So how do they get started, and how do they actually have a fair shot at some of these wonderful online resources and mentors?
So I was noticing the co-founders of Big Picture Learning, Dennis Licky and Elliot Washer, and I've worked with Big Picture. There's about a network of 50 schools all around the country, and I think to the question of finding mentors, it might be a question of reimagining the purpose of school. In big picture learning schools, the job of the school is to help students identify their passions and interests and then connect them to mentors. And then I think there is still a strong place for the school, because when each of those students are then going out and exploring their interests and passions and then coming back together, there's a kind of cross-pollination and also a mix of, we definitely leverage the online resources, but certainly by connecting it tightly to local community issues, we also develop those tight connections. So I'm really intrigued by this conversation, but I'm also thinking about the question of, like, it's not just outside of school. Like, there's the opportunity to really fundamentally redesign the purpose of school to answer and really, I think, address a lot of these issues.
I think that exactly what you're saying is completely correct. I think that one of the first places you really have to start looking for mentors, like you're saying, is in the schooling environment. The first place that you have to be looking for mentors are your teachers. I'm really interested in history. I'm really interested in doing this. I'm really interested in media. I want to make a video. Okay, let me go to the guy who does the media at my school. Let me talk to him. And just like you're saying, okay, I need guidance to do my passion. What am I passionate about? I have no idea. So it's about how can the school environment really funnel you into a position where you can get exposed to everything, where you can be working with every single teacher closely, and you can be saying, okay, what am I really interested in? And then you can be going to that teacher, and that's how you can really explore your passion. And you can be making videos, you can be doing music videos, and you can be doing things like that. But you can actually be able to do it in school. And then, you know, like was mentioned over here, my girlfriend works 40 hours a week and she's in high school. She doesn't have time to do anything out of school. But it's about how can she actually be in school, really connect with her teachers, have those online resources in school, and exactly how can she redefine the purpose of school. And by the time she goes to college, she says, okay, I know this is exactly what I want to do because high school prepared me for life and high school prepared me to really find out, you know, who I want to be and what I want to do.
And I just want to address the question about mentors. I'm a recent high school graduate, and about 2 years ago, I started working on a book on education, and I was just really passionate about it because I was feeling frustrated in my school setting, and I didn't really know where to start. I just started researching on the internet, looking at archives of basically every major newspaper, and then what I realized was that everybody in the world is connected by each other basically by an email, and you can connect with some of the most prestigious and most famous people in the world if you just know their email address. And what I did, I just started guessing emails, finding emails on faculty web pages. And it's funny because what would happen is that people would email me back saying, how did you find my email? It's not public. And it would be a pretty awkward conversation. But what would happen was that after some time, when I was doing my interviews for my book, and what I was realizing was that people wanted, in my situation, I'm a young person, people really want to talk to young people, and they really have a really motivation and a desire to do so. And one tangent to that, when I was talking with somebody like Secretary Arne Duncan, he can't really criticize me publicly because I'm a student. It would look pretty bad on his account. So I think what's important to look at is finding mentors. It's about building that relationship. On Twitter, I've made so many different friends basically by participating in weekly Twitter chats. So in education specifically, there's a chat every night. Maybe it's on social studies or in history or in reimagining school. There are all these different communities that you could be a part of, and I think Twitter is probably one of the best communities to look to because it's not like Facebook where you have to have access or you have to friend request somebody. Twitter, it's open on the web. And addressing the point about reimagining school, I think we have to realize that we have to think about reinventing school from scratch. I mean, there are some really amazing schools around the country. Big picture, there's a school called the Brightwork School by Gebertulli in San Francisco. And I think what these schools all have in common is that, first, the curriculum is based on something called the city's a school model, where they're using the resources in the community, in the city, and they're kind of bringing it back to the actual classroom. And I think we have to realize the classroom isn't that cinder block, Destin Rose, chalkboard or blackboard. It's really the world. And once we start reimagining that and thinking about the classroom as the real world in your cities and communities, that's when we really make the difference in education.
What's your book called?
One Size Does Not Fit All, A Student's Assessment of School.
I'd like to go back to your comment about the resources in school and for and or re, people that don't have enough resources. And I think that that's one of my major concerns. When I talk about the 68%, right, I really am concerned about those not beyond the 68, you know, that line, but lower than that. And I think that we're in an unfortunate situation where kids who don't have the resources to engage in these kinds of things on their own are also, and when I talk about resources, I don't just mean money. I mean psychological resources, emotional resources, support, peer support, but also familial support. They also happen to be in school districts or systems or schools that don't have enough resources to support them. So, right, we're talking about these great programs, but they're really not generally getting to the students that need them most. So one of the things, I mean, you know, this is, I guess, my wonky research side, is that I would like to see is as we're implementing these interventions, that we're also measuring how effective they are for all students, not just your most motivated students, and you know, maybe even not your most, your least motivated students, but for everybody. And to say, to be able to come up with some ideas about, like, okay, this kind of intervention is going to work well most generally here, but then how do we individualize that to the students who might need, you know, a little more because of these lack of resources. And I think that's one of the key problems, that we're focusing so much on what the kind of baseline is, and the conversation has been about failing schools and about testing, and we're not really asking about how we're failing the youth.
And so one question also related to mentors. I feel like we are talking here about mentors as being some kind of superstar and adult. Mm-hmm. So also to put it out on the table, no, what's the first place I would actually go and start for within the school is my peers. No, the student that is one class above you could be exactly as good as a mentor as your teacher, depending on what you would like to learn. And some, for example, one thing that we do at the Youth and Media Lab is work with students over a period of time, and then they go out and they serve as mentors. So not to put Gabby here on a bad spot, but it's exactly students like her and the friends she came with that I think play a big role in how you can be a mentor and support other friends and peers. So only if you want to say something, you can say something.
So, hi, I'm Gabby. These are my friends who are from a high school in northern Massachusetts. And one thing I did learn working with Youth and Media Lab is that peer-to-peer mentorships are so critical because they spread mentorships among a much wider range of students. No longer do you have to be with an adult to necessarily receive advice. You can receive it from a trained peer who can train you to also reach out to just communities that wouldn't be accessible before.
Something to sort of add to that, you know, that 20% rule and finding your passions, I would think that would make school even more of, you know, a tool for youth, as if we would be able to have the time to sort of, you know, do what I'm doing all day in that short amount of time. So you can go and you can experiment with different things with your friends and figure out what you like, and then, you know, I always find something very interesting is that all these amazing speakers often go to venues where there's not a large community that can go and see them. So not everybody can go and see them. And if we could bring those people, you know, to the schools for all the kids to see, all the communities to see, they would be able to make those connections and, you know, maybe figure out what they wanted to do while still, you know, staying in that school environment the 80% of the time, if that's what we needed to do as a first step. I think that would be really important.
In the back.
We've listened to these great stories about these great ideas and these great individual cases of change and big new ideas for reinventing the classroom, like we said. But unfortunately, as a teacher, we also see every year more and more focus on tighter and tighter standards and rote test scores. And I wonder if, especially on the research end, is there a hope that we can communicate these successes to the people that are in charge of, you know, guiding our departments of education, especially at a national level? Because it seems like these people are so removed from these great cases and these data, the research that you do. How can we make them connect, you know?
You know, my reaction to that is a strong gut reaction is, how the hell did we get here?
Great, thanks. I just want to respond a little bit. I'm just going to politely push back on the standard bashing. I'm a principal of an urban charter school, and so we're in a really low-performing district, a level 4 district in Massachusetts, where everyday kids are showing up and they're not learning. And so we need to consider the other perspective, which is that not all kids are empowered by their families, by their communities, by their schools, to be able to learn even the most basic skills, as Orr said earlier, reading and writing, that are fundamental to practicing some of these other higher skills. Alex, thank you. You also said standards are important. Not all students are ready to follow their passions. Not all students know what they are. So we're, again, an urban charter school. Our students are doing really well, tremendously outperforming the district, and we do believe that it's very important that our kids learn standards. The new standards, the Common Core standards, actually are really pretty high order thinking skills. The math has a lot of modeling, a lot of application. The reading and writing is high level. So just defense of standards, but also we have a program where we've really structured over grades 6 to 12 our kids learning how to identify issues in the community that they care about and then act on them. And we have our 12th graders then are doing acting on research papers they've written in 11th grade, and they can choose their project and go out and what do they want to do in the world. And many of them are still have a real hard time with that, and they don't know. Well, there are so many things out in the world. What would I want to pursue? So I don't think schools are enough. We couldn't ever possibly be enough for everyone, but it's just a matter of tinkering towards that and continuing to use the great stories and models that we have. Right now we're engaging in Eric's game, most of our students in Salem, trying to help improve our community through Community Planet. But, you know, you get each kid with something different, but teach them how to read, write, think, and do basic calculations, and they have a better shot at pursuing their dreams as well. Thank you.
Just to your question, thanks, Rachel. I think that puts things very much into perspective. Back to your question, though, how do researchers communicate about these findings or anecdotal evidence or increasingly also, you know, quantitative studies? I think on the one hand side, we definitely see a shift on the research side that we are more networked as well. Researchers are more networked. We're, you know, using the same tools, of course, to share knowledge and to collect the stories and to tell each other kind of the stories and learnings from our work and meet at conferences. But there is the other thing, and I know there are a number of people from the ed school in the room that I would like to hear from whoever you are and wherever you sit. What's happening on the education side, at the schools of education? What's happening there in terms of balancing and mitigating these tensions between, well, it's more standardized on the one hand side, but then you know, we agree on the potential of informal learning and more experimental approaches and the like. How do you teach that to your students, the future teachers? Who's here from the Ed School? Who's a instructor at the Ed School?
Yes, we're working on it. but I wanted to particularly say in response to your question that there, and was like, it's Nikhil, is that right?
Yeah.
So I have an email. I work for someone called the Innovation Unit as well as being at the Ed School, and we work with a couple of U.S. states with system leaders of the state, and I was CC'd into an email of a bunch of them sharing your book with each other. So they are listening, and they're very conscious of the way that the kind of ecosystem of education is changing, and they're all very worried about, you know, where their systems fit into all of that, and how schools need to change to kind of adapt to this new environment. But I think it, you know, that there is always the question of kind of how do you ensure equity, and there's a big problem about how you kind of create the freedom that can allow students to follow passions and take advantage of the great things that are out there while making sure that you're still, you know, getting everybody to the point where they have the foundational skills to engage in that. So I think the idea of like the 20% kind of thing is fantastic, because that's a really practical kind of thing that can ensure it's, you know, one way of getting balance. But I wonder if any of you had other kind of thoughts or ideas about sort of ways to change accountability so that you're kind of striking maybe a different kind of balance than the one we have now.
And I actually wanted to qualify, you mentioned about the standards bashing. I want to qualify my own standards bashing, that it's not a bashing of the standards themselves, but it's a bashing of how we have chosen as a society to evaluate those standards. So the standardization of evaluation and then needing to kind of meet those, you know, those goals to get somewhere, right? I'd spoken to some on the panel about this. In our school district, they have something called enrichment time, which is their 20%. And my friends were talking about enrichment time. And I said, what is enrichment time? What does that mean? And they said, well, that's the time when the teachers aren't teaching to the test. I thought, wow. So I think that's where my, I guess, rub is with the standards, that we've gotten to a place. Of course, I think that critical thinking skills are important, and reading and writing and math and higher order kinds of skills are important. I also think there are others that are very important that we're not focusing on either, like interpersonal skills and collaboration and social learning and those kinds of things.
Can I just bounce it over to Xavier Alex. But I wanted to hear from you, too. We only have a few minutes left, and I thought I'd bring you in as another teacher voice. And go ahead, Alex.
What I was going to say was I understand, like, the whole standard thing, but I feel like if you're going to give a student like me a standard, please make it, like, not perfect, but as best as you can, because I'm in an AP class and we don't have enough books. So you're giving us a standard, but it's hard to follow because of the fact that, okay, now my teacher has to go print out pieces of paper that I have to now take home and bring back. And so I believe that if you're going to give the you know, the public students a standard, please give it top quality, you know, as best as we can. And also about the kids doing freedom, like trying to do their own thing, I believe that at the school, opportunities are always there. Because, I mean, I debate for 2 years, and that's at the school, and that's my own time. But that's something that I really enjoy. And I take an urban improv class, which is, like, something that I really enjoy. And I really enjoyed it, and I do it after school. And a lot of kids are really against that because that's their own time, whether that means you're not really interested in that subject. Because if you're really interested in that subject, you would take any opportunity that the school gives you. So I feel like a lot of times the school does give you the opportunity. The kids are nervous or scared I feel like new environment brings out the freedom in a lot of kids, and then they want to shelter up and not be themselves.
On the standards front, excuse me. There's I'm at the English high school. A lot of eyes are on us. There is no way I would have been able to do what we did with Community Planet today. Just
really?
No way. Mm-mm. They literally would have been timed agendas. I have a 5-minute do now, move on mini lecture, move on demo, move on independent work time. And then you get a write up that says your transition from your mini lecture into reflection took 3 minutes too long. Are you kidding me? You know, and we're talking about diversification, and we need to teach all the students, but yet if something takes too long, or if something wasn't, you know as a teacher when you're looking at a child's face, either there's frustration, anger, boredom, or I'm digging this. You have to be ready to go on the fly and figure out, I'm going to work that into the next thing. And I'm one of 11 teachers that are tenured. The rest are all provisional at our school because most people either were fired or jumped ship. They're doing what they're told. And they're not, they're the craft, the magic, the pain that, that I went through for the first few years, they're not getting that experience. And that's unfortunate because I think, now I'm in my 10th year, I'm hitting my stride. I feel like I am an educator now. Before I was kind of, I'm working this thing the best I can and I'm not winning, but I'm trying hard, and now I can go to bed at night knowing that. And one last note on the mentor piece. Kevin, Kevin was a mentor for Xavier, and I think you're what, like 2 years different in age? 19 and 21. And I think, and that was a success story. I mean, was it for you, X?
It was. Mine was work. It was my family also because when people were coming up, everyone had a mentor. But everyone was a little bit older, and Kevin was right around my age, and I was like, cool, that's someone I can really relate to. So for me, it wasn't so much I had to go through the internet, but the fact that it didn't happen, that he was able to relate with me was awesome. I mean, it was a connect. Our minds were already there because he was so young, and he already graduated from English. I'm not Suffolk, now he already went to Suffolk. He's transferred. He got Emerson now, so it was awesome to have him at that mentor. So someone I pulled back on, someone I could talk to, someone I could relate with, things were tough.
And I think that's what happens a lot, when we asked, is school enough? I think I went to some of the best schools that money can buy, and I hated them. I hated school. It was one of those things, like, the bus would be pulling up. I gotta go back home. I gotta go to the bathroom. Like, anything I could do to miss the bus would be fantastic. But I look at our, at English High School, yeah, we're a tough school. We don't have all our ducks in a row, but for a lot of our kids, this is the one place that they can go where there is, it's safe. They have a computer. There isn't, we don't have, in these communities, we're one of the only, segments that you didn't go into the kids' houses and walk their streets. So is school enough for learning? No, but for you guys, is it a good place? It is?
Loaded question.
it is. I look at these guys in particular. They're always hanging around and they're always with their friends. Like, and I know in the back of their mind as they're watching all this, they're like, "Wow, do these people have friends? Like, why are they on the internet stuff?" They really are. Their peers are their support group. And then occasionally you get somebody like Alan, Michael, myself that takes an interest and says, "There's something else here, man. Let's milk this." And they respond, but it's ultimately about choice and heart.
Thank you. It's 8 o'clock, and I want to just we're going to have to wrap up, and hopefully there can be conversation afterwards. But I want to give our panel just the last word here. If you have something to say, jump in. Go ahead, Steve. Yeah.
This may seem ironic that I would take a position on standards, the one I'm about to take. I think the case to be made is that we were kind of careful not to be too critical of schools per se. I mean, we were kind of critical of what was included in educational discourse, but we weren't really critical of schools per se because we realized that there are lots of issues that are hugely complex that are very difficult to fix easily. But one of the things that I think is an entry point for being more inclusive of what kids are interested in is to sort of take the standards and then think about what the ecosystem is around those standards. And if, for example, you took Community Planet, as may be the case in the charter school in Salem, for example, or you were to take Project Noah, which was an elephant story, or you were to take Harry Potter Alliance, for example, and turn that into an educational curriculum and tie it to the standards specifically, you'd go a little ways in trying to reach kids in a way that they understood, you know, whether it was because it was a game or because it was, you know, getting an elephant to come to your town, or it was that it was based on the Hunger Games or another popular form of young person's fiction. So I think that thinking about this that way, I think, would be productive and would also keep the conversation, you know, open about the standards, which we realize need to exist, but also broaden the conversation so that it was broadened in the direction of kids and the things that they're interested in. And I think if you were to do that, you'd get it, you'd have it both ways in some ways. And that's what I would like to see, actually, is to think about that ecosystem becoming part of the standards itself.
Again, sort of adding on to what Steve said about the standards, I think that kids reach standards in different ways. And for us to set up a system or set up that space for those kids to reach those standards in the way that works best for them would be, you know, the best use of everybody's time. And it would be more beneficial to the students, to the teachers, and to the world if those kids were allowed to, you know, prove themselves and reach those standards by doing something that really meant something to them. And then they would be more motivated to reach those standards if that's, you know, one of their goals and aspirations. And sort of a thought-provoking question that I like to think of is, you know, what would happen if we gave kids the space to experiment with different things and find their passion, and then once they did that, allowing them the space to find mentors, whether it's in their with their peers, whether it's online, whether it's, you know, riding your bike to the dentist's office and meeting with the dentist because you want to be a dentist, and then allowing them to experiment with that just-in-time learning. Like, what would happen with those kids? How would education change, and how would the world change?
Well, I think the changes we've seen today in the documentary and the fundamental transformations in the learning ecosystem and teaching ecosystem, they are happening. That's not the question. That's, it's work in progress. And I think the bigger question is how smart are we about the opportunity that we've seen today, that we have discussed today, but also how do we address some of the challenges where we didn't find good answers regarding the question, of participation gaps or less privileged community members and the like. These are certainly two things we need to work on, both bottom up by experimentation. I'm very much in favor of that. But some of the comments have suggested perhaps increasingly also top down, really having policy conversations around these topics. And I'm encouraged by the event today, but also by much of the work that we've seen over the past few years in ICT and with education in particular, that we will make progress. It's an evolutionary process, so it will take more work and more resources, but I'm an optimist, and I think we'll improve our learning ecosystem, both as far as educational institutions are concerned, but also opportunities for information. Informal learning.
Yeah. And I guess it comes as a surprise to me that I'm an optimist as well.
I'm not surprised.
You're not?
No, we
That's good. That's nice, because sometimes I think I'm a realist and everybody calls a realist a pessimist. So I think I am an optimist, and I agree that I think there have to be some positive changes coming, and that there's so many movements abound that that are focusing on changing schools and on integrating new ways and new ideas for standards, new ways of teaching and new ideas for standards. And I think that that's one of the conversations that I hope that we'll have as a society soon about what else are we wanting our kids to take away from school. We think about, like, individual kinds of social problems as being caused by one variable, and I don't think that way. I think that social ills are caused by many variables and complex interactions between variables, and there's really only one way to kind of deal with that, and that's through education, and I believe our educational system can and will get us there.
I think, at least for me personally, I will continue to really work hard on thinking about ways how to include technology in the classroom and how to help this shift into a positive direction for the students especially. And I wanted to thank especially the students that came out here today. It's those events and your comments where I learn and where I grow. And so thank you for coming out.
And I just want to thank you for coming out. It's been a great conversation, and maybe a round of applause for both our panel and yourself.